Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at Graymere Church of Christ.
As we begin a new month, as we've done every month of this year, we focus on one passage of Scripture to work on getting in our mind and committing to memory. This one is from the 26th Psalm. If you would, say verses 2 and 3 with me. Examine me, O Lord, and try me. Test my mind and my heart. For your loving kindness is before my eyes, and I have walked in your truth. This quarter, as we've gone through our theme, we focused on serving God with all of our mind. And so this verse is a good way to help us remember the importance of that. As we continue through our series in Deeper Faith, we come to a part in which Jesus experiences some serious rejection. I have heard of some stories when someone preaches a sermon or gives a lesson and he gets a really harsh response. You may have heard the old joke that's one of my favorites about a man who was really proud of the sermon that he had given. He was really excited about how well he had done. He just felt really good after the sermon that day, and he was driving home just thinking to himself of all the nice things people had said and how everything just went according to plan. And his wife was sitting in the passenger seat, and she hadn't said much about the lesson. And as he was looking out the window, he started to smile, and he looked at her and he said, "How many really great preachers do you think there are? I mean, in all the brotherhood, how many really excellent, I'm talking outstanding preachers, if you had to get a number, how many really great preachers do you think there are?" And her response was very quick. She said, "I think there's probably one less than you think," which is pretty good if you're thinking about some honest feedback. Sometimes you get some harsh responses. Here Jesus is going to go into a synagogue and he's going to get a seriously harsh response. And it's easy for us to assume that as we look at our lives, that we should be able, if we're doing the right things and saying the right things, we should be able to kind of go through life and not have to deal with this kind of rejection. And yet we know better than that. We know that's not true. And so how do we respond when we receive the same kind of rejection? You may be familiar with the story of the Andrea Gale in 1991 that set off a boat with six crew members that set off in North Atlantic. They hadn't done very well on their expedition. They tried a couple of different places and the fish weren't biting, and the ice machine that they had on their boat was not working, and so it was hard for them to keep what they had already caught refrigerated. And so they decided to come home, even though weather reports didn't look very good. The last transmission that is recorded from one of the crew members was recorded from Captain Frank Tyne on October 28, 1991, where he was describing the storm and he said, "She's coming, boys, and she's coming on strong." And that's the last they heard of that ship. In fact, the story of that expedition and the crew members being lost at sea was made into a book titled The Perfect Storm. There was a movie made after that later on. It was an incredibly noteworthy news item because you had these people who had been out there kind of on their own and now they were lost at sea. And the author of the book, Sebastian Junger, had a quote that I thought was very interesting as he described what he learned as he researched that book about fishermen. He said, "There are many kinds of work that are dangerous. But one of the interesting things about fishing is that it hasn't changed much over time. It's been mechanized, of course, but the basic reality of going to sea for months at a stretch is the same as it was 100 years ago. You're way beyond help from anyone else. You're on your own. I think that forms a certain kind of character." He described how fishing hadn't really changed over the years. It's still basically the same process it's always been. And he said, going out at a time when you're on your own still hasn't changed. As I read that quote and I thought about that imagery of being out there on your own and trying to do your best and get as much as you can so that you can bring it home and that you can sell it, that you can make a living, I was reminded of an image we see several times in Scripture used by Jesus when he's calling his apostles, when he tells them he'll make them fishers of men. As we think about our role as Christians, following in those footsteps, trying to reach out to others and fishing for souls, going on expeditions to try to bring others to Christ, I think sometimes it's easy to feel like we're on our own. After all, the process hasn't changed since what we read about in the New Testament. The process is still the same of trying to reach people with the gospel of Christ. And sometimes we feel like we're out here and we're just sort of floating on our own, and things might get stormy and things might get difficult. And when we try to reach others, it's as if we have no other resources. We're just out there by ourselves at work, or we're out there at school, or maybe some other context where you feel like you're completely on your own. And what I would like for us to focus on this morning is the fact that Jesus gives us an example of how to deal with rejection. And you might be thinking about a conversation you've had one time with a close friend about spiritual matters and about how it hurt when that person didn't respond the way you had hoped. Or a family member that you had prayed about talking to for months and finally got up the courage to do it and things didn't go quite the way you planned. Jesus gives an example of how we can understand that circumstance and how we can deal with it. And so I'd like for us, beginning with the passage that was read for us, I'd like for us just to walk through what takes place as Jesus comes here to his hometown. Verse 16, Luke tells us, and he came to Nazareth where he had been brought up. And as was his custom, he went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day, and he stood up to read. Now we see here that this was something Jesus did regularly. We remember Jesus lived under the old law, and so he observed everything that a faithful Jew would observe. And part of that was going to the synagogue services. And based on some later Jewish writings, we have a pretty good idea of what would happen in a synagogue service. We can kind of project back into the time of Jesus. And likely it would have begun with everyone reciting the Shema from Deuteronomy chapter 6 about loving the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and with all your mind. Incidentally, that's part of the basis for our yearly theme, is loving God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. It probably would have included some other passages, one from Deuteronomy 11 or Numbers 15, maybe some other benedictions that would have been recited. And remember, this is an oral culture. So when people come together, they don't have copies of God's law, the law of Moses, they can carry around. So they're repeating these things in large part to help them remember it. And so when they would come in, they would repeat these things. And then after that, you would have some prayers, a portion of the law would be read, and next, a portion of the prophets would be read. And it seems, if we're thinking about this kind of traditional understanding of what would have happened in the synagogue service, it seems that it might have been at this time that Jesus reads this passage from Isaiah. In verse 17, the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it is written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because He has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who were oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And he rolled up the scroll and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. And the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. And he began to say to them, "Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." I'd like for us just to pause right there and just try to picture yourself in that synagogue on that day. Try to imagine what it would have been like to have grown up in a household that was searching for the Messiah, and to hear someone that you know come in and to read this passage from the first two verses of Isaiah 61, which clearly seems to indicate a messianic prediction, and you hear this person that say, "This scripture is being fulfilled today." How would you respond? If it was someone you knew, what would you say? How would you react? In verse 22, at the time, all spoke well of him. In fact, they marveled at the gracious words that were coming from his mouth. In other words, these were kind of amazing them. They were almost entranced by these gracious words. They were wondering. They were in awe and in amazement at what Jesus was saying. And then as they start off with this positive reaction, the latter part of verse 22 says, they said, "Is this not Joseph's son?" And he responds to them in verse 23, "Doubtless you will quote to me this proverb, 'Physician, heal yourself. What we have heard you've done in Capernaum, do here at your hometown as well.'" And he said, "Truly I say to you, no prophet is acceptable in his hometown. But in truth, I tell you, there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the heavens were shut up 3 years and 6 months, and a great famine came over the land. And Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to Zarephath in the land of Sidon, to a woman who was a widow. And there were many lepers in Israel at the time of the prophet Elisha, and none of them was cleansed, but only Naaman the Syrian. When they heard these things, all in the synagogue were filled with wrath. And they rose up and drove him out of town and brought him to the brow of the hill on which their town was built, so they could throw him down the cliff. But passing through their midst, he went away." Why would they start off so positively and then reject him? Why would they look at Jesus who comes in and reads this message and reject him? I think we see a couple of reasons here in the text. The first seems to indicate that they thought they knew better than he did. They thought they understood the mission of the Messiah better than Jesus did. After all, this is something they had been waiting for their entire life. This is something they had been looking forward to. Surely they would have understood how that passage was supposed to be used. And for Jesus to stand there and to say that it applied to him, well, they thought they knew better than that. They thought they understood more than that. After all, they had seen Jesus grow up. In fact, verse 22 has them saying, "Isn't that Joseph's son?" When we read Matthew's account of how the people in Nazareth react to Jesus, we read in Matthew 13:55, they're asking, "Is this not the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? And are not his brothers James and Joseph and Simon and Judas? And are not all his sisters with us? Where then did this man get all these things?" They had watched Jesus grow up. Have you ever gone back to your hometown and had someone say, "Wait a minute, aren't you so-and-so's son? Aren't you so-and-so's daughter? Don't I know your grandparents?" I grew up going to Horizons, which our youth group attends every summer. And one year, I can remember, they had a big kind of get-to-know-you event where you would go through and you would meet other people from other congregations. And they had all these games you would play. And one booth was a karaoke booth. You know, you could get up there and you could choose from a selection of songs and you could sing and they'd record it. This is back in the days of cassette tapes. So they'd record it on a cassette tape, you know, and give it to you. And I can remember my friend and I got up there and I'm sure, you know, we thought we would be really cool and sound good. We were in about sixth grade, you know, and we got up there and we sang a song and I got the little cassette tape, you know, and I took it home. And I guess I had expected us to sound really great, and we didn't sound all that great. But I can remember listening to that song, and about halfway through, the recording equipment was sitting right here where the counselors were standing who were in charge of that. And one of the counselors apparently leaned over to the other counselor and said, "Isn't this the Phillips kid?" pointing to me. And I remember thinking about that. You've probably heard that before, haven't you? "Wait, aren't you so-and-so's child? Wait a minute. Don't I know you? Don't I know your family?" That's a little bit of the reaction we get here with Jesus. He's here in his hometown and he's saying all these things and people are starting to say, "Well, wait a minute. Isn't that Joseph's boy? Don't we know him? His father's the carpenter, right?" They're talking to each other. They're saying, "Isn't that Mary's son? Wait, aren't all his sisters here? Don't we know who his brothers are? Where is he getting this?" In fact, even Jesus' family would have a similar reaction. Mark chapter 2 tells us that in verse 21, his family heard about these great crowds that are following Jesus, and they went to seize him because they thought he was out of his mind. Even Mary, just a couple of weeks ago, we saw her great faith in the fact that she was going to have the Son of God. Even she started to doubt what was taking place. There's something that's not right because of all these crowds. They thought that they knew better than him. They thought that they knew him. And because of that, they knew better than what he was saying. And so they didn't want to hear this. John 7 in verse 5 tells us that even his brothers during Jesus' ministry didn't believe him. At the time that John is writing about in Jesus' ministry, they didn't believe what he was saying. They didn't believe the message he was trying to spread. In fact, Peter would even, after Jesus had predicted that he would die and all the treatment that would take place at the hands of the Jews, Peter rebukes him in Matthew chapter 16. But that's not going to happen. He thought he knew better than Jesus. And so that may be one reason that they rejected him. They didn't want to hear about that. And it may be just because they simply didn't want to hear his message. Because there's something very specific that Jesus says in relation to the prophecy he reads from Isaiah. And that is, he points to two stories from Scripture. One with Elijah and the widow of Zarephath, and then one with Elisha, who was the successor of Elijah, and the healing of Naaman the Syrian. Both of those stories had one thing in common. They were about God showing kindness and showing mercy and performing a miracle for individuals who weren't Jews, who were Gentiles. And so what Jesus is saying here is that he's the Messiah, and he says, no prophet is received in his hometown, but let me remind you that there's only one person that God sent Elijah to, and that was a widow of Zarephath. There was only one person that we see healed here in this specific case of leprosy, and that was Naaman the Syrian. Elijah, in a drought, is commanded by God to go to this widow of Zarephath, who is in such desperate straits that she tells him she just has a little bit of flour and a little bit of oil, and she's and her son are going to eat those, and then they will die. That's how desperate they were. And yet Elijah has to go to her and say, by the way, God commanded you to take care of me. God commanded you to feed me. And God performs a miracle to make that happen. And then Elisha, who comes after Elijah, and it's easy to remember because it's in alphabetical order there. J comes before S, and so Elisha comes next. And we see Elisha being the recipient of a visit by Naaman the Syrian. And he's desperate because he has leprosy, and a servant girl has told him about this prophet who can heal individuals. Elisha doesn't even come out to meet him, but just sends the instructions to him about going to the Jordan River and dipping 7 times. And Naaman's initially reluctant, but finally he does. And when he does, he's healed of his leprosy. And so Jesus uses these to remind the people of something we're going to see over and over again in Luke's Gospel, and that is God's plan was not just for the Jews, but for everyone. That when God sent Jesus into the world, it was always His plan to redeem the entire world. All His creation. That wasn't just a footnote. That wasn't just something that got added in at the end. Jesus is saying here very clearly that God plans to make grace available not just to the Jews, but also to the Gentiles. And that probably wasn't something they wanted to hear. That probably wasn't something they were excited about hearing. And yet it's what Jesus said. And if we think about these two reasons, I think we don't have to look far to see the reason some might reject Jesus today. The reason some might reject the message of Jesus today. It's likely because, as human beings, we might think that we know better. We might think that we've moved beyond these things that are written in the Bible, and that these commandments of Jesus are outdated or outmoded. Maybe there are some parts of the message of the Bible that we're embarrassed about. Maybe even feel ashamed of when we're thinking about the broader community maybe of scholars or those who are experts in our culture. We might even feel ashamed of some of the things that the Bible clearly teaches because it's out of step with the message we're getting from so many other places. In fact, just this week, you probably saw or heard about the video that a man named Bill Nye, who's known as Bill Nye the Science Guy, did promoting evolution. And so there was all kinds of response to that. And understandably, there were people who were responding and saying, hey, wait a minute. And what I noticed about that whole thing was that the chance that many took to say, isn't it even laughable that someone would believe that God could create the world? That's just foolish. That's just laughable. There's no way that could happen. And so you've probably had a conversation with someone who just laughed at the fact that you believed in a God that could create. Or maybe we think about the resurrection of Jesus, that we know to be the power that gives us the encouragement that when we die, that won't be the end, that there will be something else. We know that from Scripture, and yet I watched just the other day a series of interviews that were done by Lee Strobel, who's written a number of books, and one of them was asking about Jesus, and the individual who was responding said, you know, I have a lot of theories and a lot of thoughts about Jesus, but I just don't think being risen from the dead is something that could really happen. You may have had a conversation with someone who believed that. Maybe we're tempted to kind of shy away from some of those truths of Scripture because we're afraid that people might think that they know better than that. We might feel outnumbered in certain aspects of our faith. Maybe there are moral issues about which we feel we've outnumbered, or we think our standards are going to be seen as old-fashioned by some. By the way, if we feel that way, we're in the company of the Christians in the first century. We know especially in places like Corinth or in Ephesus, there were issues like that where Christian living seemed to really contradict the things that were seen as okay in that society. So it's really nothing new to feel outnumbered in that way, but sometimes we feel that way. Or sometimes individuals might think they know more than Jesus. And by the way, this isn't just limited to those who are not Christians. As Christians, several times we might think we know better than God's plan. We might pray prayers where we'll say we want God's will to be done, but we've sort of already planned out how things need to happen. And what we would really appreciate is just sort of the stamp of approval on what we've already decided. Sometimes we think we know better than God, or we think we know better than His plan. And so how did Jesus respond to this kind of rejection? I think there are a few things we see very quickly. First of all, the rejection did not surprise Him. Jesus quotes that proverb about a prophet not being welcome in his hometown. We can understand how that might happen. We know what it's like if you're around people that watched you grow up and that know all the embarrassing stories about your adolescent years, and the people who sat behind you in church when you were sitting with your friends, or the teachers that you had in class when you were making those mistakes and doing those things that you might not be proud of. We understand how that might happen, not being acceptable in your hometown. But I think there's a larger reason that Jesus understood that this was going to happen. Because when we look at the Old Testament prophets, we see that in many cases, they weren't accepted by the very people they were trying to help. Here, they'd been given a message by God, and they were trying to help those people, and they weren't accepted. Verse 14 of Luke chapter 4 reminds us of the connection between the Spirit of God here. Not just that Jesus is fulfilling the mission of the Spirit, obviously that's the case, but it's also a reminder that Jesus is doing what Old Testament prophets did, and that is He's going in, preaching a message inspired by the Spirit of God. And because of that, rejection probably didn't surprise Him. Rejection also didn't change Him. All throughout either the growing up years of Jesus or the ministry of Jesus, we see a strong connection with His Father. Whether that's based on conversations He's having in the temple when His parents go to find Him in Luke chapter 2, or whether that's based on the times He steps away from His ministry in order to pray and to commune with God. He had a strong relationship with His Father. By the way, did you notice it was His custom to go to the synagogue? I think that's very instructive for us. After all, if there was ever anybody who walked on this earth that could say he really didn't have to go to the synagogue, or it really wasn't important for him to be there, wouldn't it be Jesus? And yet Jesus was there. In fact, when he goes and opens this scroll and goes to this passage in Isaiah, it's not like him just picking up a copy of the Bible like we would have with the table of contents or maybe some tabs or bookmarks. He's unrolling a scroll. And we don't have the chapters and verse numbers. He's going specifically to that place. It seems to indicate he was familiar with that scroll. His relationship with God was strong. And if I want to deal with rejection that might come my way for being a Christian, my first order of business is to make sure my relationship with God is what it needs to be. And so it was Jesus' custom to go to the synagogue. I think that's instructive for me. Anytime I think that, well, I don't really need to be there, I think this is a good example as we think about worshiping today. And so we have His message also that remains the same. His message is one that doesn't change. No matter who He's around, whether He's around sinners that might have been at the fringes of society and He was looked down on for associating with them, or whether He was with the religious elite, or whether He was with His family, He had the same message. And you and I are only going to be effective if we have the same message that we consistently live out, if we're the same people here right now that we are Tuesday morning at work, or that we are when we're hanging out in the neighborhood on the weekend, or when people see us around town. There's only one way we're going to be effective, and that is if we're the same person with the same message. And Jesus was. Also, rejection didn't stop Him. This rejection wouldn't stop Jesus. In fact, when they tried to take His life, remember, that's how seriously they took blasphemy. And they assumed what Jesus was doing is blasphemy. When they try to take his life, he just walks away from them. I'd love to see how that worked. It seems to me like there was some divine power that was taking place here that would allow him just to escape from a crowd of people that were wanting to take his life. But it didn't stop him. In fact, there were other times when Jesus would go into situations that people thought were dangerous. One of those is in John chapter 11, when Lazarus has died and Jesus is wanting to go back in Judea, back in Bethany, to the home there of Lazarus and Mary and Martha. And his disciples say, wait a minute, if we go back there, that's the area where people want to take your life. But Jesus is going to accomplish his mission. So how should we handle rejection? Rejection shouldn't surprise us. There will be times when we have conversations with people about the gospel and they're not going to respond. And I need to be prepared for that. Several times Jesus would tell his apostles that they would experience rejection. In chapter 15 and verse 18 of the Gospel of John, he would say, if the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it hated you. Just a few verses later, in 16 chapter 2, he would tell his apostles that they will drag you out of the synagogues, that there will be a time when people who take your life will think they're serving the Lord. And even in 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 23, Paul described the gospel as something that caused Jews to stumble and seemed foolish to Greeks. And so as we think about how it is when we share the gospel, we need to be prepared for some rejection. A rejection should not change us either. Our relationship with the Father has to remain strong. It has to be something that we're cultivating, that there's a relationship with God that's cultivated by spending time in prayer and in His Word. We've got to do what's in our power to keep our relationship with God strong. We know that if we do our part, God will do His part. And then rejection should not stop us. You may be thinking this morning about a specific person you've talked to. And maybe their rejection was harsh. And maybe you even felt foolish. Can I encourage you? Please don't stop sharing the gospel. If you've shared God's message with someone who has rejected you, maybe never even looked at you the same way after you had that conversation, can I encourage you? Please don't stop. Rejection should not stop us. It's easier said than done because we know what that feels like, but it should not stop us. We have a number of ways that we can reach out to others. We try as a congregation to have a lot of events and a lot of times where it's easy to invite someone to be a part of those times. I hope that we'll do that. I hope that we're planning on people we can invite to worship or people we can invite to our family weekend or whatever it might be, things that we can do to connect with others. And I hope we won't let rejection discourage us. As I thought about these things, I was reminded of what I was privileged to experience on Friday. I attended the funeral service for a young lady named Sarah Walker in Nashville. Many of you know her or know the family or know her story through her writing. My sister-in-law became good friends with her in college, and the families remained close ever since. And she's a young lady who passed away after a long struggle with cancer, and her life and her writing was very inspirational and very encouraging. And there was one thing that was read that I thought about when it was first written on her blog and then when they read it Friday. She described how she wanted people to remember her, and she pointed out something we tend to do, and that is we tend to say someone lost his battle or lost her battle with an illness. But she said that she did not want that to happen. In fact, just a quote here, she said, I'm sure it's my competitive side talking, but when I hear that statement, it implies to me that something else was the victor. Oh no, sir, my victory is in Jesus, and I will be the victor no matter what happens to this temporary earthly body. And so she set out some statements she would prefer people to say about her, that when someone passed away, that I went to his eternal reward after battling cancer, or received her crown of life after enduring cancer, or whatever it was, you fill in the blank, that it wasn't a loss, it was a victory. And then she had the words of victory in Jesus written there. It reminded me, as I thought about this lesson, that Jesus is described in many ways as someone who was rejected by men. In fact, verse 3 of Isaiah 53 says, he was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, we esteemed him not. And yet Jesus understood what truly mattered. You see, there is going to be victory. We don't need to be discouraged by rejection because we know that the rejection in this life is not the end of the story, that there is victory along the way. And when we know who's won that victory, when we know that that's in store for us, then we're going to have the power and the courage to be able to share that message with others, because it's too important for me to be discouraged by rejection if I know there's a victory coming and I want someone else to be part of it. We're not out alone at sea, floating around, being tossed about by storms, seeking for help or comfort as we try to fish for souls. We have a God that watches over us, that loves us and wants us to spend an eternity with Him. There's going to be a victory in Jesus. If you want to make that victory yours today, it's a victory that Jesus has already won on the cross and through the resurrection, and yet the opportunity for you to be a victor, for you to be a conqueror, still exists. If you need to make that decision, if you need to come to God, if you need to put Christ on in baptism and begin living the Christian life, you can do that. Or it may be that you felt like you're alone, that you're being tossed about by the waves and you just need some help and encouragement. If we can help you in any way, please come as we stand, as we sing together.